been so wild lately. He doesn't seem to listen. He doesn't obey my commands, and we can't even bribe him with treats.
He's gotten so out of hand, he may even have to be put down.
God is not the problem here. The problem is the people who want to be the leader of the pack. We reintroduce God. We retrain people. You're listening to The God Whisperers.
Early one morning while making the rounds, I took a shot of cocaine and I shot my woman down. I went right home and I went to bed. I stuck at 11:44 beneath my head. Got up next morning and I grabbed that gun. Took a shot of cocaine and away I run. Made a good run, but I run too slow. They overtook me down in Juarez, Mexico.
You're listening to the world-famous God Whisperers. I'm Craig D'Onofrio.
I'm Bill Swirla. It's Johnny Cash's...
Why are we listening to Johnny?
It's Johnny's birthday today, dude.
Happy birthday, Johnny. How old would he be, do you know?
You know, I can look that up. In his 70s, I believe, had he survived his life. Style.
There was some hard living there for quite a while.
Well, you know, even listening to that song, you know, with that, you know, that I don't know what they call that. What's that distinctive background, that, you know, that kind of thing going?
That's country rock and roll.
Yeah, I know, but there's a name, there's a musical name. Anyway, you know, it sounds like a train, doesn't it?
Right.
And
right,
when I listen to Johnny, it's train wreck all the way. Yeah, I mean, it is a train wreck. His life, but he died September 12th, 2003. He was born February 26th, 1932. He died at the age of 71 of diabetes.
Oh, 32. He'd be 84.
Okay, so he'd be in his 80s. 80. Yeah, that's right. 13 years. 84 years old today. 84.
Wow.
You know,
died a believer. We'll rock with him in heaven.
You know, and I'm happy for that, too. When I was a kid, I loved his show from the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just fascinated by it. I was fascinated by the man, you know, they would just wear these black suits. And black. It was just all in black. You know, that black guitar that he played and the voice. And he always sweat. I mean, the man looked like he was working when he was probably like strung out, but the man looked like he was working and he looked hard. You know, this is the kind of guy when you walk into a bar and there's some guy at the end of the bar nursing a double scotch or whatever, you know, that's Johnny. I mean, it's hard but you know, just awesome, awesome music. And I'm not even a real country fan, but Johnny Cash kind of he gives voice to the sinner. You know,
he
tells the truth. He tells the unvarnished truth. I think that's why the guys in prison loved him. You know,
I mean, he was real. I mean, and this was in a time and day when you weren't allowed to be real.
Right.
Everything had to be clean and sterile or the record companies wouldn't carry you.
Yeah, well, that's
the fact that he got busted for drugs. He almost lost everything over that.
Well, you know, there's that Johnny Cash movie with Joaquin Phoenix and what's her name?
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Blonde girl.
Blonde girl. Lost her name. But anyway, but that's a good movie. And Joaquin Phoenix does a great, great Johnny Cash.
Yeah,
I just really credible one. But they kind of bring that out because, you know, he starts out in gospel. He's doing gospel music.
Right.
And that's a hard genre to crack into, you know. And then he starts going off the edge. I mean, he starts getting real, and that's when he starts doing these prison tours. And his life is just, you know, it is a train wreck. He wrecked his marriage. And he's having this affair, and he's again, you know. And it's what's beautiful is it's all overlaid with that Bible Belt Christianity too, you know. That's always lurking in the background. And so yeah, I love it. I love it for its inner conflict. I mean, it is the Semel life. Maybe he doesn't give voice to the sinner. He gives voice to the Semel.
Now, let's see. I think it was Jerry Lee Lewis. I was related to Billy Graham. Is that right?
I don't know. I didn't know that.
I think they're cousins.
No.
Yeah.
Fact check. I think that, all right. We're going to do a fact check.
It seemed
right now.
Like Johnny Cash was related to someone like that, but then maybe not. But I think it was Jerry Lee Lewis and... Let's Google that real quick.
You just keep talking.
All right. Anyway, with Johnny Cash, because of my age, I don't remember Johnny Cash before the 70s. And there always seemed to be not just that hard edge, but also something kind of kindly about him at the same time. That maybe it was just the era and the guys that I knew that listened to him. But there seemed to be something there that wasn't just hard, but also something almost fatherly or grandfatherly about him at the same time. Maybe it's just my dysfunction and my crazy family. I don't know, but hard to say. Find anything?
Well, you know, I'm kind of looking at, I'm wondering if perhaps it's Jimmy Swaggart, who's related
to
Jerry Lee Lewis. Although there's some, so it's Jimmy Lee Swaggart.
Let's see here. I just did Jerry Lee Lewis related to, oh, wow. Related to Jimmy Swaggart and Mickey Gilley.
Uh-huh.
There we go.
Interesting. Yeah. Real is the way to put it. I mean, Johnny Cash just tells the unvarnished truth. And,
oh, wait. This could be priceless.
Yeah, what do you got?
YouTube, Jerry Lee Lewis and Jimmy Swaggart.
Oh, gosh. Let's see. What can possibly go wrong here?
Oh, I think this is more of a documentary kind of.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's not dueling banjos or anything like that.
And I asked him, I said, yeah, yes, Jerry, but what about your soul?
What about your soul?
Yeah. He never answered me. He dropped his head. His eyes once again filled up with tears, and he got in the car and drove away.
Destination. Oh, some sort of documentary on the two.
There you go. Okay.
But,
That's a great question, though. I like that. What about your soul? Yeah. I like the way these old Baptists talk. I wish we Lutherans could talk that way. How is it with your soul? What about your soul?
You know what's amazing? Jimmy Swaggart and his big fall from grace and everything. I think I've talked about this before. When I was serving church out here in Missouri, I would drive home late at night. I'd get together with our old buddy Steve Flo, and we go grab a late night after our 3 or 4 hour Sunday nap. Go grab a late night dinner and a movie or something like that. And I drive home, and there was this guy on the radio that kept preaching about Christ alone, the blood of Christ alone is sufficient and all this. And this went on for like 2-3 months, and I wasn't in the car. I wasn't going to sit in the car for a half an hour to find out who this was or anything. But one night, I finally came in the house and turned it on, and it was Jimmy Swaggart. The guy was preaching justification, grace through faith alone. Now, he's still a crazy charismatic and everything, but I think the hard times that he fell on, he actually came to understand grace. Well, it's amazing.
You know, it's that's right in line with C.F.W. Walther, and in one of his theses in Law and Gospel, he talks about the distinction of the Law and Gospel is taught by the Holy Spirit in the school of experience. So this isn't an academic exercise. This isn't something that you kind of pick up in a textbook somewhere, but this is something that's lived out. And So somebody who's kind of, especially as a believer, I would say a corollary is that being simultaneously a sinner and saint is something, yes, it's a theological thing. It's a corollary of the law and the gospel, but to fully understand it, that's lived out in the school of experience. And that's what somebody like Swaggart, I think probably came to a fuller understanding. See, that's what the holiness guys deny.
Right.
You know, they say, I'm holy now, or I'm making myself holy. I'm becoming holy. I'm climbing up the ladder of holiness or whatever. And they deny the simul, this paradox of the Christian life that we are believer, unbeliever, in Adam, in Christ, however you want to put it. And that's the condition for the rest of our lives until we die and rise finally.
Yeah, this was the linchpin for me to become a Lutheran, was once I started to understand that I'm simultaneously saint and sinner, things started to fall into place. All of a sudden, baptism made more sense.
Yeah, and not as something
It was kind of like that last number in the combination that made all the tumblers click into place.
Ah, yeah.
And that was it. Once I discovered that, it Lutheranism made sense.
The lock-picking analogy.
Yeah, you don't get that very often.
Always resorting to criminality and thievery. So that's always, you know, it's good. I used to get in trouble when I was teaching Korean pastors. For a while back in the 90s, I was doing some teaching at Concordia Irvine, and they had this program where Korean pastors were trying to become Lutheran or wanted to learn about Lutheran doctrine. So they had me do some teaching with those guys, especially over the summer, kind of crash courses. One thing I'll say.
Why didn't they have a good Lutheran pastor?
One thing I'll say is that Koreans are some of the friendliest people in the world. Probably because they've been subjugated by almost everybody, and they love food. If you want to meet Asians who truly love food, and they're notorious food fusers, they'll fuse anything together. Again, an outcome I think of subjugation. But they just couldn't wait for lunch. Lunch was just like the highlight. Friday lunch was just a treat, but I had to be careful with my analogies because. At the time, I was reading a lot of Robert Capon, so I was using a lot of drinking and gambling analogies because they work.
Right.
You know, the god who hides himself behind dumb luck, or you know, the god who serves up, you know, 200 proof gospel, and they didn't like that because the Korean Christians are pretty pietistic, and so they didn't like the drinking and gambling analogies. So I had to kind of dial in a different image set. You know, you got to keep your images like in groupings. Okay, this one will work for youth. This one works for the LWML. This one works for Korean pastors. You know, you have to watch your imagery because you know, all theology is kind of analogy at some level, but you have to choose your images wisely. So that's how that
you know went. There's a podcast called The Moth Podcast. Have you ever heard of that one?
The Moth Podcast? I have
not. It's a podcast of people who just come and tell stories. And I was listening to one of these programs yesterday, and it was all chefs.
Oh,
and nice. Roy Choi was on there.
Roy Choi of the Kobe food truck fame.
Yeah. And so anyway, Roy is talking about his first gig out of the CIA, Culinary Institute of America, not the you know, spy thing.
That's a little bit like Adam on Northern Exposure. You know, the guy who's always being followed by CIA operatives out of Nicaragua, and he's also, you know, he's culinary trained in France and with some of the finest chefs you know, in the world, and nobody believes him, but everything always somehow comes out true at the end of the episode. My favorite character, Alan Arkin, it was his finest moment.
So anyway, Roy, who's Korean, he's talking about the first time that he was involved in slaughtering a goat.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
It's really good. You need to go find it, The Moth Podcast.
Moth Podcast. I'll be all over that.
Maybe they'll talk about us someday.
Our friend Sandra just tipped me off on a great new Netflix documentary. I don't know how many there's four up, and that may be the extent of it. And I think it is. It's Michael Pollan, Pollan. The guy's genius. I love this guy. And it's basically a documentary based on his book Cooked. And the major segments are the four elements of you know, the old Aristotelian science: earth, air, fire, and water. And so he kind of does a culinary anthropology. So I watched Fire the other day, and man, is it good. Interesting anthropological theory. There's some anthropologist who believes that cooking is what caused our evolutionary branch to split. That is, you know, some higher ape walked around and after a forest fire and found some, you know, some medium rare gazelle nicely charred on the outside and had this bright idea to cook. And so at that point, and they have kind of an interesting sort of diagram about how we're the only species that cooks. I mean, I've never thought of this before. This is like phenomenally interesting. And as a result, we have smaller, weaker jaw muscles and smaller teeth. We don't have to grind constantly. You know, watch one of our, you know, watch an ape. He spends 80% of his day chewing. We don't have to, do that. So, but they reason that, see, cooking, first of all, it frees up time. If you're not chewing 80% of the day, you have time to think. Also, the smaller jaw, smaller mouth, more front-oriented face allows bigger room for the brain. See, so you got a bigger brain cavity. So it's very, very interesting. Now, you know, whether you buy that anthropological explanation or not, you know, who cares? But the idea is we're the only species that cooks. And in cooking, we save oodles of time because it's like cooking kind of pre-digests things. Eating raw food takes a lot of time and a lot of digestion. It's very inefficient. So it speeds things up. We're made to eat soft things, things that have been cooked. And the fire episode, I'll tell you, if you didn't crave a steak before, in fact, they're doing an outdoor scene where they're doing, it's kind of cool. They do Aboriginal people who kind of go out. They live sort of basically modern lives, but they go out into their wilderness, and they do the wilderness thing, kind of like Israel in the Festival of Booths. You know, they kind of dwelt in huts to remind them of who they are. So the Aboriginals go out into the bush country, and they hunt and they camp under the stars, and they tell stories and they cook with fire. And so they had that bunch, and then they had some North Carolina pit master, you know, this descendant of slaves. The guy's just a genius at whole pig. And then they had Michael Pollan and some other guy in a backyard doing kind of the suburban version of that. So the juxtaposition was really interesting. Aborigines, North Carolina pitmaster, a couple of guys in the backyard in suburbia somewhere. But at Michael Pollan's barbecue dinner party, one of the guests there was a vegetarian. And she agreed to go off her vegetarian diet for that evening. And I don't know when the last time she ate meat was, if ever, but the look on her face when she eats her first mouthful of perfectly done pulled pork, it's, how can I say this?
It broke her.
Oh, instantly. You see this kind of like, it was like the dawn of consciousness. It was like that opening scene in 2001, A Space Odyssey, you know. I mean, first of all, there's this kind of puzzled look. What is this? And then the eyes get wide and the smile breaks out. And she says, oh, wow, I had no idea it was that good. So it's like, oh, yeah, well, that's the end of her vegetarian days right there, you know. But
the endorphins started to kick in.
And she
was, it was all over.
But anyway, this Cooked. What a great series. And I like being challenged with strange anthropology. I find it really fascinating.
I was just in Prague last week.
Oh, and Prague.
And I think I had duck almost every day. I'm so addicted to the duck.
Not good for the cholesterol numbers, my friend.
Well, I take pills for that.
So oh, okay. Then you're bulletproof.
Better living through chemistry.
Absolutely.
Man.
You know, I mean, you know, if my doctor said, look, either cut out the cheese or take the pill, I'm filling out. I'm grabbing that prescription as fast as he can write it.
Thanks, you know? Great.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You get this phenomenal duck with like the red cabbage.
Oh, yeah.
And these dumplings and all this. And the bill comes, it's like $8. It's crazy.
Is the exchange rate really super favorable?
Yeah, it's 24 to 1.
But how does that actually translate? I mean, you're actually getting good value for your American dollar over there?
Yeah, you know, because I'm 6'1" and I weigh about 280, and I need to get back on that.
You gotta get on the program, dude.
But I got to get back on it. But I'm still down a substantial amount. I was over 300 before. But anyway, because of that, whenever I can, I upgrade my seats on the plane, get that little extra leg space.
Oh, and the rest of us, thank you too, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I've had the big man sitting next to me, you know, and it's like, really, really.
Well, it doesn't help with the width, but just that little bit of leg space is the difference between my knees being jammed up against the seat in front of me and not.
Oh, yeah. See, here's my deal is, you know, I fool people if they're sitting at table with me because they think I'm taller than I am.
Because you're all torso?
Yeah. I'm like a 6'1 torso on 5'9 legs. You know, I mean, I'm a committee job. I'm a genetic freak. I'm a mismatch. I don't know what happened. I'm my dad. My dad was that way too. But it totally freaks people out because they think I'm taller because I'll be like eye-to-eye contact at the table. And then we get up, you know, and I'm staring at their chest. And I'm shrinking too. I'm down an inch. You know, because you know, you get to my age and the whole thing collapses because we ain't made to stand upright. I'm sorry. I don't care what people think about, you know, Adam and the whole deal. But that upright vertebrae thing, you know, gravity's working against you the whole way. So, you know.
Yeah. So anyway, I go to check on to come back. And it asks if I want to upgrade to more lake space.
Oh, yeah.
And it says it's going to cost me like 804 crowns.
Crowns.
Yeah, crooners. And so
crown him with many crowns.
So, my mind automatically goes to dollars. I'm like, oh, heck no.
Whoa, there's yeah. No way I'm like, doing man, that, I can't right? afford that. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I do the math and it's like $35.
Oh, okay. Well, that's suddenly in the realm of reasonable.
Yeah, to fly from Amsterdam to New York. With more comfort for like $35.
Oh, like, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but my initial response was 800 something crowns. No way. And right. Then you realize, oh, wait, that's less than $40.
See, I don't have problems with that because my legs fit into any situation. Volkswagens, it's not a problem. I mean, I'm good with all that. In fact, one time I gave up my Uber legroom seat on a Southwest flight to one of the Sacramento Monarchs basketball team who had a knee injury. And so she was trying to like fold. She was like 6'6", okay, and all legs.
Yeah, she was probably a point guard too, right?
Yeah, all leg, and she had this knee brace on, obviously some sort of knee injury, and she's trying to fold this frame into one of these 737 seats. And I said, I think you need this seat more than I do. She goes, really? I said, yeah, you know, I had that jumper seat where there's nobody in front of you, and so you right. can, and oh, she, you've never seen a more grateful look on somebody's face where she just kind of like stretched, and she took up all the legroom available, believe me. But that was a very interesting flight. I was surrounded by some very tall women.
Hey, I was over there to do work with this. It's called the Network of Young Lutheran Theologians, and these are young pastors and theologians. We had guys from Finland, from Sweden, from Norway, from England, from Germany, from Czech Republic.
How young do you have to be to get in the
all
club?
All over the place. Most of these guys are 45 and younger.
Oh, I'm out. Okay.
And we had like 60 of them. And man, were these guys solid.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm hearing Nagel speak and I'm like, what the heck?
Oh, yeah.
You know, these guys. And then I find out they studied why did I draw a blank? Professor up at Fort Wayne, the Japanese Nagel.
Oh, Masaki.
Masaki.
Naimichi.
Yeah. They studied with Naimichi, and so I'm hearing all this. I'm like, where did you guys
hear Japanese Nagel.
Yeah, the Japanese Nagel.
Nagel-san. Yeah, yeah. No, that's amazing.
Anyway,
these guys
were fantastic. The future of European Lutheranism is looking mighty fine, if you ask.
That's heartening. That's very, very good to hear. And because there's been like a really bad wrong turning in Lutheranism, you know, in traditionally Lutheran lands, and to see a revival with the rising generation of Lutheran theologians, and that's very, very encouraging. Hopefully they don't go into the sort of how do I describe it, the sort of the closed circle. You know, kind of like sometimes when we go conservative, we kind of go Amish. We get very insular. And we're afraid of anything. We're afraid of anything that challenges. You know,
I can't really speak to that so much. But the conference was mostly about reaching out to Islam in Europe.
Oh, that's big.
And it was very evangelical. All the talks were very evangelical. Very concerned about reaching out to the refugees and all these other people with the gospel, and stories also about stuff that's going on in Germany in particular. You know, we keep hearing about Pastor Martins and his church. This guy has two baptism classes going on at the same time with 200 people in each class.
Yeah, he reminds me of that guy. You've told the story a couple of times on our show before. That guy, he's on the East Coast somewhere and just kind of like in this moribund parish going nowhere.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then some Africans showed up on his doorstep and pretty soon
Liberians.
The whole village showed up, you know, and that was, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think the independent, the independent Lutheran Church in Germany, it's a great moment for them.
Well, and it's not just Martins that this is going on. You know, there's story after story about Lutheran pastors in this region. And the thing that's amazing is how you and I talk a lot about God saying, yeah, I can work with that, whatever it is. I guess in Islam, the only way that these people expect to ever hear from God is in dreams.
Yeah.
And story after story, this is just mind-boggling to me. Story after story of after service, someone's just kind of loitering in the narthex, and you know, kind of brown skin, and everyone's leaving, and the pastor will walk over like, "Can I help you with something? I had a dream, and Jesus told me to come here to hear the truth."
Yes, I have.
It's just like, what?
I've heard this. This is it's almost, it's eerie. Yes. In fact, I was just at a meeting of our board of regents for the Concordia for the Fort Wayne Seminary. And we were talking about Islam and converts from Islam. And I mentioned this. I said, you know, this is a consistent story that there are a lot of converts from Islam who claim to have seen either a vision or had a dream of Christ saying something to the effect, "I am the merciful one whom you seek or whom you worship," or however it's put. And the reason I'm inclined to believe this as being the real deal is it ends up with them being in the church, you know, at great risk to their lives. This is not a trivial decision. This is not like deciding to become Lutheran from the Baptist church. Most Baptists, I don't know, because you know, to my knowledge, they don't kill you when you do that,
right?
Except in certain parts of the South. But
you know, and the thing that, and you're touching on this also, the thing that is awesome to me is that these people aren't being told outrageous, crazy things. They're being told, go to this place where they do this word and sacrament thing and find the truth.
Yeah, it's like an Ananias moment. Go to the street called Straight.
Right.
Okay, this isn't some kind of, you know, either weird visionary thing. I mean, this is go there, talk to these people, get baptized, you know.
Right.
So yeah, it's an Acts moment. It's just amazing, and I think it's going to be a huge shot in the arm to the Lutheran Church in traditional Lutheran lands. It's a great moment.
And also let's take a break here, but when we come back, let's talk a little bit about the diaspora that's coming, a Muslim diaspora.
Oh yeah.
Where they're taking Christianity back to their lands when they return home, because something like 70% of these people want to go home. God, anyway, we'll be right back.
God is resourceful, isn't he?
Yeah.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine, I walk the line. Well, my daddy left home when I was 3, and he didn't leave much to Ma and me, just this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. Now, I don't blame him because he run and hid, but the meanest thing that he ever did was before he left, he went and named me Sue. Well, he must have thought that it was quite a joke, and it got a lot of laughs from lots of folks. Seems I had to fight my whole life through. Some gal would giggle and I'd get red, and some guy'd laugh and I'd bust his head. I tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue. Well, I grew up quick and I grew up mean. My fists got hard, my wits got keen. Roamed from town to town to hide my shame. But I made me a vow to the moon and stars, I'd search the honky-tonks and bars and kill that man that gave me that awful name. Well, it was Gatlinburg in mid-July, and I just...
You're listening to the world-famous God Whispers. I'm Craig D'Onofrio.
I'm Sue.
Hey, Sue.
I'm a theologian named Sue. For the day. Gosh, I love Johnny. I loved it when I was a kid. I remember that song, you know, the dad's car just have that slide dial AM radio in it.
Yep.
And whenever that song came up on the radio, I told dad, turn that up. I want to hear that. I love that song.
Anyway,
Sprachzunge. He was doing it before rap and before Mark Knopfler. I mean, he's way ahead of his time.
This is one of the things that's really, really fun is you watch that Johnny Cash movie, and I think that it's true in that people say, well, why don't you play faster like Gene Vincent or someone like that? And he's like, this is as fast as I go.
Yeah. No. You don't speed this up.
Right.
No.
So anyway, that's his.
It has its own heartbeat, you know, and it's a train. It's a locomotive. It's just going at its own pace, and there's no stopping it. You know, it's just going.
Anyway, to wrap up what we were talking about there, that the really exciting thing about these Muslims that are coming in and hearing the gospel is that over 70% of them want to go home when hostilities calm down and everything. And, you know, there's a good chance that thousands and thousands will go back as Christian believers and evangelists. The ISIS could be one of the greatest evangelistic tools of the millennium when you think about it, which is really bizarre.
Well, it's one. I think it's illustrative of how God seems to operate in this world is you throw anything at him and he'll use it.
Right. I can work with this, and I'm just really excited that I get to go to Europe and be part of all of this, to work with this, to publicize this, to take it to the media, to bring it home to everyone else, and also to serve congregations. And where I'm going to run into these people, and it's just a phenomenal opportunity. I'm really excited.
What's your timetable? What are you looking at right now?
Well, we have to raise about $175,000.
Is that the total or left to raise?
That's the total. We've raised about 25 to date.
Oh, so we've got to speed up that train.
Well, we've only been at it for a little over a month.
Really. Oh, okay. That's pretty good.
A month and a half.
Yeah.
We've got a long way to go. But we'll be out in California. We're going to come out right after Easter and hit churches fast and furious. So you're on my hit list, by the way.
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll be out there for probably about 2 months, and Concordia Irvine's putting us up, which is just phenomenal.
Oh, that's nice. That's good.
Yeah, for free, which means, you know, I love my mom, but staying with mom for 2 months. There,
no.
A death.
2 days, 3 days, that'd be nice. I got like a three-day rule, and
right.
Then you start to, you know, two things happen. One, it's inevitable. It's relational. It's who she is. She becomes your mom again, okay?
Right.
And you become her little boy, and it's like, no, I'm a man. I got stuff to do, okay? I'm out of here. and the other thing...
And why don't you come home every night for dinner?
Yeah,
working here,
you know,
that's why.
And then you realize, I don't know how your mom is, but you realize that like, the shoe's on the other foot now, and so, you know... You feel like the adult, and your mom is kind of being. My mom's really funny. She has this mischievous streak in her, and she thinks that lying to the doctor, she got away with something. She says, "Well, I didn't tell him."
That's just gonna get you killed.
I didn't tell him everything. Well, why not? He's your doctor. I mean, you're supposed to tell him stuff. Oh no, he's just gonna prescribe more tests and pills and stuff. So she doesn't tell him stuff, you know. And I think, oh man, you know. But
anyhow, Paula and I have a blog now. So if you want to follow
Paula up. Paula and I have where do you find the blog?
See what we're up to with this whole
Paula
mission
and
travel thing and everything. We're slow on putting stuff out.
How come Rufus isn't in it?
He is.
He's the webmaster, and he's running the blog.
Paula just put something up on him.
Where do we find this, Craig?
It's craigandpaula.org.
Not Paula and Craig. Craig and Paula. It's actually Paula and Craig in real life, but on the web, it's
Order of Creation, man.
Order of Creation. Were you created first?
Yeah, actually, I was.
Oh, okay.
I'm a year and something older.
So that is the order of creation.
But if you wanted to go the pecking order in the household, it'd be Craig, Rufus, and Paula. Because Rufus thinks that he's Paula's boss.
Is that working from bottom up, Craig, Rufus, Paula?
No.
Oh.
This is Rufus logic because I've picked Rufus up by the scruff of the neck and had to throw him out the door when he tried to bite someone. So he understands that I'm the big dog, and then he's next in line, and then he bosses Paula around.
That's the dog pack arrangement.
Yes.
You're the alpha dog. He's the beta dog, but he's alpha to Paula.
Right.
You got to be alpha to somebody.
Yeah, I suppose
so. So he's got her wrapped around his little paw or whatever whatever dogs wrap around.
She lets him push her around way too much.
You know, it's the corgi.
There's the corgi pushiness and then the Rottweiler protectiveness.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, I was watching the dog show. I love that dog show in New York. I'm not a dog person, but the dog show, it's pure entertainment. And they had the corgis there and the Rottweilers. So I started thinking about Rufus, and I'm trying to think of what Levitical laws were violated when Rufus was conceived. But, I mean, that is forbidden.
I'm pretty sure in the book of Leviticus, the corgi was wearing some sort of cotton wool blend. Also,
clearly, yeah. But you can see the hints of that personality, especially the corgi.
Yeah,
especially the corgi.
So he's got the corgi.
He shows a lot of corgi.
But if you try messing with Paula, he'll kneecap you real fast.
There you go.
He will not tolerate his woman being.
So again, the website where we can find the Paul and Craig show.
CraigandPaula.org. Yeah.
Okay.
I preached at a
Is it monetized? Can you give money right on site?
Yeah, if you click on the Give Now button,
oh, you can.
It'll take you to the Synod's website where all the donations.
Really? Okay. Oh, that's good.
You know, people keep asking me about why don't you do like some sort of crowdfunding thing and that. And I've asked Senate about it. And they're, oh, you have this button here. So why do you need that?
They don't roll that way. They don't understand $1 from a million people.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is one of those things around the year 2125. They'll figure out the crowd.
I heard an interesting talk from a professional fundraising consultant at my latest Regents retreat. And it was very interesting because he corroborates what the socialists have been telling us for a long time, that 90% of the wealth is being is held by less than 10% of the people. That seems to be fairly solid. And but he wasn't concerned about that. This wasn't like an appeal for Bernie Sanders or something like that. But what he was saying is that it's changed the way people do fundraising, and his strategy was to target the uber big givers, the people who are in a position to give $25 million, $10 million,
right.
$5 million, and they're out there, and there are actually quite a few of them numerically. But he had this great graphic that showed how basically. You know, 90% of the population does not have, I don't know, 90%, that's a singular, does not have a lot of disposable income. So it's also true that 10% does most of the heavy lifting in giving. And so his strategy is you really got to go after the big guys, and it's got to be relational. You got to sell them. You got to sell them really big. They got to really want to be a part of it. You know.
And, well, there's this, but also with the wealthy, especially they're rich because they don't throw their money away, and so you have to show them a solid return on investment. There has to be a really good reason for them to invest in what you're
doing.
Yeah,
but here's the deal. You know, when you ask somebody in church to give 10% of their income, you know, for some single mom who's, you know, maybe making 30 or 40 at most and right. trying to raise kids and save for college and, you know, all this, you're asking, you know, you're saying, okay, look, don't go out to the movies or don't eat out so often or do something. When you're talking to this group, that's not on the table. They've got this huge amount of wealth, and they want to invest it, as you say. And it's not just return in terms of monetary return. There's other sort of non-monetary returns,
because
they have a sense of wanting to leave a legacy, wanting to make a difference, put their money to work, that kind of thing. But you're not asking them to give up stuff. There's plenty of room for their stuff. This is coming out of a different bucket, and that's really the big thing. You know, the dollar here, the $5 there, the thing the church is used to, the widow's two mites, very, very important, not to be despised. And you know, in fact, in that particular instance, that was her whole life, her whole livelihood right there. But in terms of when you're looking at funding things, The people who are in a position to really make things happen are the people that got a lot.
But I tell you also, though, if I could get 200 or 300 people to pledge $20 a month or even $15 a month or something like that, that goes a long way toward getting us deployed.
Oh, absolutely.
I think it's that recurring gift. It's not the one time $50.
Well, yeah. If somebody's going to give, it's great. If somebody's going to give $10 million to something, that's not a recurring gift. Okay. No, that's right. Going to be a one timer for a specific thing. But, you know, with something like this, I don't understand why the sort of the mass appeal. All the politicians are doing that. I mean, that's what drives a lot of these campaigns is social media. Give $5. All these college students giving a couple of bucks here and there. You get a million of those. Do the math. That's a lot of money.
Well, I had a friend who ran for governor for California back in the early 90s. He was a UCLA student. He was a sushi chef or a sushi waiter, rather. And he ran... actually a pretty successful campaign. He got a pretty good block of votes. Really smart guy. But anyway, the campaign was, we accept no donations over $99, because back then, I don't know about now, anything over 99 had to be reported.
Oh, okay. So it just keeps it off under the radar.
Right. So if you were, say you were a local congressman or assemblyman or something like that, and you donated $99, there would be no record that you donated that money to this subversive candidate.
Yeah.
Really, really successful.
That's good. But, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, you look at like what GoFundMe or what is it is that you can put anything down. And even like, you know. There was some woman who was just getting funding because she'd spent everything on lottery tickets and didn't win, and so she wanted people to fund her to buy more lottery tickets, and people were doing it. So if they're that dumb, you know, for something good. And here's the other thing: there are going to be people who are supportive of what you're doing who may not be in the Lutheran fold per se. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And that's a different sort of thing, and I'm not sure we're comfortable with that. Again, it's that insular mentality. Lutherans take care of Lutherans kind of thing. I'm not sure that's really, you know, we seem to be moving into a thing where I don't know what it is. I'm going to become a futurist. You can just prognosticate all day, but it seems like there's kind of increasing fluidity amongst the traditional boundary lines seem to be getting kind of blurry here. There are people who are, you know, talking serious law gospel and proclaiming really good gospel who are not really of the Lutheran fold per se, but we're very, you know, we saw that with that Tullian guy or whatever, you know. I mean, there seems to be a lot of that going on.
Well, just last week was the Christ Hold Fast conference in Florida.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And you know, we have friends, Donovan O'Reilly and others, who spoke there. And
I think it's just Donovan Riley.
That's what I said.
Not O'Reilly.
Donovan Riley.
It's Bill O'Reilly and Donovan Riley. Not related.
Checked out there for a second.
Not related. Separated by an O. Apostrophe.
Sorry, Donovan. I knew that. It's Craig Donofrio. Anyway, you know, Donovan was there, Jeff Mallinson, Concordia Irvine, Dan Van Voorhis. A lot of these guys, LCMS Lutherans, were there speaking. But there were also Calvinists there. And some of these guys were going on about sacramental, you know, the sacraments and sacramental theology. And the Calvinists were getting excited about it. And I'm thinking, this is very interesting. There are videos online. You can find that.
Yeah, I think that may be our counterpart to what you were describing in Europe, you know, that rising generation of new Lutherans who are who have shed some of the baggage of the past and are kind of, you know, moving in a different direction. This may be true across the board. This may be our version of that. And you know, God, ever the divine opportunist. I used to think that God was like an artist, like in the realist school. You know, he'd sit with his very fine brushes and he'd detail everything and stuff. I'm starting to think that God's more like Jackson Pollock. He just throws paint on the wall or in the universe. You know, when you look at like the pictures of the Hubble telescope, this just looks like Jackson Pollock abstractionism. You know, I think he just throws paint and says, oh, that's really good. I can use that. You know, what are the odds of making an Earth? Well, there are actually finite odds that if you throw enough galaxies out there, an Earth will pop up somewhere. You know, I can use that. That's good. I really like that.
Well, you have an article coming out that's somewhat related.
Yeah, well, it's a quick think piece. The editors of Lutheran Witness approached me, and boy, they should have known better. Well, it was a seeded question, so I didn't have a choice. But the question was, you know, I love science. I believe in Big Bang Theory. I also love Scripture. I'm a Lutheran. Can I wed the two together? Can I wed Big Bang cosmology and the Scriptures together? And that's kind of a refashioned question, but that was the gist of it. And my answer was, well, you know, science and Scripture can be best friends and get along really well, but I don't think that we should. They should wed. They should. They maybe they can live together. I don't know, but they shouldn't. They shouldn't wed. Per se. And then I went on to kind of explain what I mean by that. I didn't say live together. That wouldn't have passed, you know, in Lutheran circles. But I do think that science and Scripture are two ways of knowing things or explaining things or expressing things, saying. And they're complementary, but they're not harmonizable in any way. So science can speak of billions and billions of years and Scripture can talk about, you know, God's work week. And I don't think these are incompatible. And the nice thing about the Scripture is that some ancient Israelite wandering around the wilderness could understand this. He would not have understood Big Bang Theory. I'm just saying. You know what I'm saying? In fact, I think if God would have revealed that through Moses, or that would have been the vehicle, the thing would have been discarded as utter nonsense. You know,
so what's he spouting here? How do you work this together with the, you know, that a lot of people will kind of make it a point of orthodoxy, a six continuous day creation and a day of rest, you know, and all of that. How do you make that gel with Big Bang Theory?
Well, my answer is you don't make it gel with Big Bang Theory. Okay, so you don't make those days into like bazillions of years. That's not going to work. You know, kind of the old age creationist kind of way of doing that. The day is eon. Day means day. Week means week. It's meant to reflect Israel's worship life. It's sacred time. But you know, it's not geological. It's not even scientific. I wouldn't even take that as a scientific observation. It's theological. It's much more than that. And actually, interestingly, once you get out of that mode, trying to harmonize, you know, what we know from science with what we're reading in Scripture, once you get out of that mode, you start to see things in the text that actually make really good sense, even to us. Okay, so like, for example, the plants and the animals, God doesn't like make them directly. They don't just pop into existence because he says so, but he says, let the earth bring forth. So they all trace their heritage back to the earth. They're of the earth. And so God works through means. He works through the means of earth and water. You know, before anything was, there was water. The deep covered the earth, and the wind of God blew over it. So water, word, spirit. You know, so it's baptismal language, and even the ordering of things, kind of, it makes sense, and it puts the whole creation in kind of an order that makes sense. So you don't have to harmonize. I think you'd have to delight in what it says, and especially what it says about Christ and what it says about God. And it basically rescues us from paganisms, from worshiping the sun, the moon, the stars. They're just instruments of God, you know, and recognizing who we are. But I less and less I have this need to harmonize.
How does that work with the law of non-contradiction?
That's our rule. That's not God's. That's our rule. We make up those rules and we say God's got to obey our rules.
My theory is, and really, I am so confused on this that I'm almost an agnostic on matters of how God created. And I think that I do that out of self-preservation. But, you know, my take on it is, if God wanted to, he created Adam fully formed as a fully formed man. Why not create the earth well aged, like a good wine?
Yeah, the trouble is that apparent age thing. You know, but it makes God out to be kind of either a charlatan or a trickster or a liar. It's like, fooled them. You know,
he does whatever he wants. It all looks old.
I will grant that if you create something fully formed, it will look old. Okay, so if Adam just pops into existence, and I don't think the text says that. But if Adam just pops into existence, then yeah, he's going to look, you know, I tell that story to the kids. I I said, so Adam is sick. You know, he's created on Friday, and the next Friday he gets sick. So Eve goes to the pharmacist, and pharmacist says, how old is he? And she says, a week old.
Oops, sorry.
And she says, a week old. And so he gives her a prescription. It doesn't work. So she comes back and says, well, you know, how much does he weigh? So, well, it weighs 180 pounds. I said, oh, why don't you say so? You know, in other words, the naturalistic view is usually more helpful to us in our day-to-day existence. And so I don't think you can harmonize these two. Plus, the science of the Old Testament is the science of the ancient Near East when it was written. You know, otherwise it wouldn't have been inerrant. Think about that. You know, if they would have used Newtonian, or if they would have used, you know, Einstein's physics in the Old Testament, that would have been perceived as an error. There you go.
Honestly.
Hey, if you want a good book.
I'm looking forward to reading your article.
If you want to. Oh, I don't go into that in depth. This is a Luther and Witness article.
The article is going to leave me with more unanswered questions.
Hey, here's the deal. You want to read a good book that'll bend your mind. Kenneth R. Miller, Finding Darwin's God. Fascinating book. That's all I can say. He finds Darwin's God, by the way.
And it
really coheres, although that God sounds vaguely Buddhist-y, but that's to be expected, because what's Buddhism? It's a natural theology. What does Romans 1 say? You know, you can only know so much by observing created order, right? And so basically, but he gets it right. God is both transcendent and immanent. He's beyond the telescope and he's beyond the microscope, because in science, once you get into that subatomic thing, you hit indeterminacy. See, and that's a great place for God to hide, because you can't get a bead on him. You can't even get a bead on an electron. So, you know, that's a beautiful thing. So that's the place where science gets a little foggy, because things get very indeterminate very quickly. Same in deep space and, you know, the whole Big Bang Theory. You go out far enough and things get kind of really weird. We start talking black holes and all this kind of stuff. That's a great place for God to hide. And he can be perfectly sovereign and imminent and tinkering away, and you'd never get a bead on him. Never see him. Never see it coming.
He is kind of a wily fox.
The divine suspect may leave his fingerprints, but good luck catching him.
Hey, we've got about 5 minutes before I got to hit the road here.
Well, we got time for one quick thing. Brian McLaren.
Okay, yeah. The Angry Hymns.
Yeah, he has determined that hymns are too warlike. And in particular, he's rewriting Onward Christian Soldiers, as Lemker did. But Lemker, of course, wrote like a college fight song. But he says our hymnody, McLaren's one of these emergent types, our hymnody should be refocusing on the teaching of Jesus about peacemaking, steering clear of warlike imagery. And author Russell Moore, in Our Christian Hymns Too Warlike, on RNS, Religion News Service, he takes exception with that. He says McLaren's completely missed the point on this.
What are some of the other hymns that are kind of warlike?
By the way, when I was a kid, I hated that hymn, Onward Christian Soldiers. I mean, yeah, that one's unfortunate. That one's a case of, I think, tone deafness. You know, yeah, the Crusades, kind of not always a good thing. I know there's the Crusades are complex history, but there are a lot of you go to the church militant section, even A Mighty Fortress is rather warlike.
Yeah, there is that.
I mean, you know, it's written against the papacy, and of course the devil. But I think that
thy strong word did cleave the darkness. That's
although that's not warlike. It's sturdy. Who's the guy we had a long time ago? The manly man guy. But you know, he was talking about we need more manly hymns in church. Mm-hmm. I guess you know, and manly hymns are going to have that militaristic feel. You know, and the Militia Christi theme is an ancient theme. It's not the most biblical of themes, but Moore says correctly. He says, look, this isn't sort of an accretion to Christianity. This is the Bible, and the warfare, of course, is spiritual warfare. But and John Kleinig has a lot to say about that topic. And I think we have to be careful. We don't just kind of say, oh, it's all peace loving. You know, Paul says our enemy is not flesh and blood. that we're waging a spiritual war, you know, the powers, the principalities, the rulers of darkness, all of this stuff. But it still is war. We're the church militant. And so rightly understood, those warlike images of the Old Testament, they still apply. I mean, we're not fighting nations. We're fighting the devil, the world, and our flesh. But still, you know, and you know what it is? It's more of that speech thing. Oh, here's this. He says, this doesn't make us more violent. It makes us less violent. When we know that we're wrestling against principalities and powers in the heavenlies, we are able to understand we're not therefore wrestling against flesh and blood. Sometimes we forget that. When we know that those who oppose us are, as we were captive to the devil, we're able to treat them with kindness and gentleness, says 2 Timothy. So, you know, it's like know your enemy. Who's your enemy here?
Well, the enemy's time in general.
No.
Always working against us.
Time is malleable. Time is flexible. Space-time continuum, that whole thing.
Well, we're out of here. We'll catch you next time on the God Whisperers.
Absolutely.
Always look on. Adieu. Parting is such sweet sorrow.
William, move your head.
There's something in the dark.
Look at the size of that boy's head.
Take it easy, dude.
Good night, Dad.
Bye, Mr. McKenzie.
Fine, go, you savior hour.